We're from Portland, I'm from Portland, and runoff from parking lots and cars leaking chemicals.
I'm with him. I'm born and raised in Portland.
And also here in parking lots, okay, great. The second row?
Actually, Bellingham, we just moved there a year ago, and it's a very pristine seeming area that they've begun to build all around the lake. It's our watershed, and it has this brilliant in it, and Gardia. For people with bad immune systems, they're suggesting they go pick up some responsible food water from the city. Beautiful area.
It's a good one.
I'm from Indiana, and I'm interested in the sediments behind the sediment of drinking water.
Yeah, it's a big issue in Indiana.
I'm from the Puget Sound area, just interested in my own impact on what may be the problem.
Mm-hmm. Puget Sound area, a little different perspective. I'm a builder, but interested in being able to do that in conjunction with everything else.
My interest probably is from being the third world countries where disease is a major problem and it cannot be controlled without proper sanitation water.
When I came here 25 years ago, you thought nothing of drinking water coming out of mountain streams. Now you don't dare do it.
That's true.
Well, I think it's changing, but it seems to me that there's still an awful lot of people, and certainly not the people here, I guess, but that really don't think too much about water. And they take it for granted, like the air they breathe. And there's a limited amount of water, and there's an awful lot of people that don't want to pay very much money to get clean water. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's going to take.
Yeah, so true. And for the back row, we're just going around saying one quick issue that we're concerned about the environment. So let's go across the back row.
Steve Lindstrom, Elgin, Illinois. Just wonder what to do about garbage.
Great.
Beth Murphy, I just did garbology. I'm just aware of how unconscious in general people are.
There's nothing like doing garbology and we'll to be very aware.
From Portland, we had a fairly decent watershed, and now we're thinking about taking water out of the Willamette River to make up what we don't have out of the watershed after we mismanaged the watershed.
Okay, well, thank you. I think that's about as good an introduction as I could possibly have given to the many diverse issues that we're concerned about with water. As I said, we're going to talk about mainly non-point sources today, and that indeed is most of what you have raised, this diffuse pollution that comes from around a watershed. And in fact, that's the most important source of pollution today in the last EPA report to Congress, which is sort of the only general report we have on the quality of our nation's water, is what it's called. About 60% of the waters that are impaired were impaired due to non-point sources, they figure. So it's not the overwhelming source of pollution, but it is the majority source. It's the combination of agriculture, of parking lots, of yards, of landfills, they can be called a point source, that go in combination lead to degradation of our water supply. And again, let me just review the terms point and non-point source pollution. Let's hope that this is not a problem. I just have some overheads, and I hope that you can see. I mean, if you can't, it'll be all right. But I just thought this was easier than trying to explain it, to draw a picture. So we have point source pollution that usually comes out of a pipe directly to a stream, and that's why we can call it a point. Because, boy, you can go there, you can set up your monitoring station, and you can get the water right there, and you know what's coming out. And the important thing about it is it requires a permit since the Clean Water Act of 1972. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. But those are the sources that have been so dramatically cleaned up. Sewage treatment plants are big ones, and industry are big ones. But anywhere that something comes out of a pipe, we can call it a point source. And in general, all of them in the U.S. are regulated. Well, I shouldn't say that, because then people always ask me about agricultural drains, and they're not always regulated. But sewage treatment plants and industry would be, and as a consequence, have changed dramatically over the last 25 years, 26 years now, since the Clean Water Act. But But the other kind is non-point source pollution, and it's more and more called polluted runoff. This is especially the environmental organizations that think that people can't get really excited about non-point source pollution. Does it seem like that way to you, that it's not much of a grabbing title? So now they're talking about polluted runoff, which is a perfectly fine word. So I'm trying to use that more and more too. It's just that, you know, what it is, what it's defined by the fact that it doesn't come out of a particular point. And because it doesn't come out of a particular point, it's very difficult to monitor. And that's one of the main reasons that it's not regulated. So all of you who are concerned about things like parking lot runoff, yard runoff, you know that nobody is out there monitoring what comes off of that. Indeed, it's not regulated for the most part. But that may change soon. So we've got agricultural fertilizers and pesticides. I didn't hear that brought up a lot. And that may be a fact that most of you seem to be from the West. I'm from the Midwest, where this is really on the top of a lot of people's agendas, and at least the ones we get away from Lake Michigan, where there's the strong industrial contamination problems. But soil erosion, runoff from roads, I mean, those are just examples. And all the other examples that you people gave are good, too. So as I mentioned briefly, the Clean Water Act of 1972, which probably many of you remember the passage of, has made a dramatic difference in the way in our nation's water quality. Unfortunately, it's hard to make strict comparisons because before that, nobody was measuring. Nobody was trying to get a handle on the nation's water quality. So they can only make rough guesses. But what they say is back then, probably about a third of our nation's water was what's called swimmable and fishable. And those are the, I'll talk about that in a minute, but that's what our goal is, for all of our nation's water to be swimmable and fishable. Probably in 1972, about a third was. And now in 1996, let's just say the most recent time for which there's a report, about two-thirds is. So it's a very dramatic improvement, but it may not be good enough. I mean, that depends on people's thinking, but many of us think that that's not yet good enough. And when people in wonderful Southern California can't use their beaches, I'm sure, especially, they don't think that it's good enough. Or all the other people who have experienced water in their own backyard that for some reason cannot be used as they'd like it to, probably agree that that's not good enough yet. So there are still some problems with these point sources. In Indiana, at least, we're hearing all the time about combined sewer overflows when it rains a lot and the sewage treatment can't handle everything. If the two sewer systems, the sanitary sewer and the storm sewer, are hooked up together, then it's inevitable that the sewage treatment plant can't handle everything and they dump raw sewage into the rivers. I think that's a pretty common practice in old cities. It's a very difficult practice to regulate. That's one of the major point source pollution problems that's happening today, and that they're still working on a lot. But otherwise, we're starting to see that if we're going to make an impact on that final third of the waters, we've really got to look at the non-point sources. And that's a lot easier said than done. Seems obvious we need to work on those, but it's not easy at all, because it's not very likely that we're going to get up and set up monitoring stations off of every yard or neighborhood or part of the city or however we would do it. So I wanted to say a little bit more about what it means to be impaired. We like to say water is dirty or clean or something like that. I mean, you feel like you know when water is polluted or when it's not polluted. But they had to draw up some standards, some way of saying when water is okay or it's not. And the standards are in terms of its designated uses. And there may be different uses where you all live. But the general use, as I said, that our nation's water is supposed to have is swimmable, and that's mainly a reflection of the E. coli levels, as you, Emmy said. That's the way that it's generally monitored to decide whether it's swimmable or not. So they go out and they measure the bacteria levels, and if it's above the number 235 per 100 milliliters, that's how they, you know, it's the number that they've set, then the water is not considered swimmable. And it's not, you've probably heard this, it's not a problem of those particular bacteria. They won't harm you, but if E. coli are there, then that means that there's a direct path for fecal material to get there, because it's come from some animal. It may be human animals or it may be other animals. But that's where the E. coli comes from, and so that leaves, that means that there's an open pathway for viruses or protozoa, cryptosporidium or others to have also gotten there, and that's why they close beaches for swimming. And at least in Indiana, that's the most common source of cause of impairment, is the E. coli levels, because they're almost always too high. But fortunately, people aren't trying to swim in most of our waters, but it is especially a problem in those waters that they are trying to swim in. In Indiana, I know that 81% of our of the streams and rivers that they monitor and lakes are not swimmable. And I'm sure it's different in Oregon and Washington. That's Indiana. And the other use that all our waters have is aquatic life. We want our waters to support good, healthy fish. We want them to support fish, and then we want the fish that are caught there to be edible. And there may be places that you're aware of where you can catch plenty of fish, but you can't eat them. And that's usually a result of either mercury or PCBs, which is a long since banned contaminant. But those things get in the water, in the sediments, and they stay in the sediments. And many of the fish are not edible because of that. We have fish consumption advisories, again, on quite a number of rivers in Indiana, and I assume that's the same in other places, especially downstream of usually an old industrial discharge. But we want our water to be swimmable and fishable, so that's our goal. But once we realize that there's a problem, like I say, it's very difficult to get rid of. We can't just say to the sewage treatment plant, you need a better treatment system to discharge less to the lake. We can't just, and then monitor and see whether they do it. That's what we've done with the Clean Water Act, and in fact, we've provided money to communities to improve their sewage treatment system. And industries are all, they all have permits to discharge a certain amount into a river, and then that's monitored to see how much they actually discharge. And you can get information on all of this. If you're interested in what industries are discharging into a stream that you love, for example, you can go to a worldwide website run by the EPA, punch in the zip code, for example, or the county, or however you want to search for that, and up comes all the permitted discharges in your area with what they're permitted to discharge. Now that site at the EPA doesn't give the actual amounts that they're allowed to discharge, but you can get all those. It's public information, and that is available to anybody who's working in watershed management, whether a volunteer group or a government agency. Unfortunately, the same is not true for those non-point sources. And again, I work primarily with agriculture, but we also work with residents, and I think I'm glad somebody said that they were a builder. That's all these important uses that we humans make of the land, and it's very difficult to know how much we're even affecting the water, let alone what to do about it. Just one thing I thought I would do real quick is give us a specific situation in a lake in Indiana and try and give the perspective from the different groups. And this is a situation that's just been happening over the last few weeks. So I have seven rolls here, okay? And I'm just gonna pass these around, and if you wanna read one of these rolls, take one. If you don't, just pass them on, okay? And we'll get seven people that are interested in doing this. So don't feel any pressure, because there's a lot more of you than that. What this is a lake in northern Indiana. It's a little bit north of West Lafayette, where I am, and they have a major recreation industry. People come down from Chicago and over from Illinois. I don't know why they come from Chicago. Maybe it's more from Illinois, because they've got Lake Michigan. But this is a nice little lake made by a dammed up river. It's called Lake Schaefer, and over the last few years, they've been doing a lot of monitoring for E. coli, because there's a $40 million economy for a pretty small county that depends on the quality of this lake. And July 17th of this year, as I wrote it, the headlines broke. I mean, this was, at least for our part of northern Indiana, this was major headlines. Bacteria threaten Lake Schaefer, water quality crisis. These kind of words were used to describe what was happening in this lake. you know, water quality crisis threatens $40 million recreation industry. And that, it was because they had found levels in the lake over that E. coli standard. And so as these headlines got out, the tourists didn't want to come anymore, of course. And this huge recreation based economy, they feel is threatened. I mean, it hasn't gone away at all. And the health department, which samples the lake, and they also sample the tributaries, that's their job to do, found levels as high as 100,000 bacteria. They call them colony forming units, which is roughly equal to one organism. If you know how they do bacteria, I'm no biologist, but you know, they put the water on the petri dish, I think, and then see how many spots they have colonies forming from, and so it's roughly equal to an organism. So up to 100,000 colony forming units or organisms per 100 milliliters, while the standard is 235. So once levels like that get in your headlines, you can imagine that these poor resort owners and you know, everybody who rents out cabins and there's this big thing called Indiana Beach, which is a huge sort of amusement center, and they actually have their own water, they're right on the lake, but they use a separate water source, so they actually weren't threatened at all, but people, you know, associate the whole thing together, so, you know, that's a very major tourist attraction.
And are they not part of the problem?
They have their own sewage treatment system, okay. So they could be. I didn't give them as one of these roles here. Mm-hmm. So they could be. So anyway, business is starting to drop off and as word spread of the bacteria levels, and the main thing is everybody wants to know the source of the contamination. We got to get at it. We only can stop the contamination if we know where it comes from, right? So that's the first problem. So this is the kind of discussion that's flying and that we've been pretty involved with over the last week. So all of these voices that I just wrote down here are actual voices of different concerned people. So let's just go through this. And I didn't say this before. You can either read your part or you can ad lib. If you're a farmer and you have something to say, you can make it better than what's written there if you want to, okay? But we'll just hear from these different voices. First, number one, a farmer. Is somebody number one a farmer? Okay.
Read this?
Yeah, just read it. Mm-hmm.
Septic systems have been a problem on the lake for years. People build beautiful new homes on lots with old, failing septic systems.
Mm-hmm. Just contractors of it.
Many of the lots are too small for adequate septic systems. Everyone knows they are failing. People want to blame us farmers, but we're making efforts to protect water quality and are following all regulations. Many lakefront properties, however, are out of compliance with septic regulations, and we're sure they're the main cause of bacteria in the lake.
Okay, next we'll hear from a county commissioner. Do all counties run on the basis of commissioners or something like that? Okay, so he's one of the chief executives of the county. So is someone him?
Yes, a sewage treatment plant needs to be built to replace the lakefront septic systems. Too many are out of compliance. Nothing can be done to replace them since lot sizes are too small or unsuitable. We've worked out a plan with local, state, and federal funding assistance so that a modern sewage treatment plant can be built for the cost of only $35 to $40 per home per month. This is the best solution to the septic problem.
That's right.
Okay, but now let's hear from a homeowner, number three.
We have a good septic system and have to maintain it. We should not be forced to pay for a sewage treatment plant we don't need or want. We've been here for years, and we don't need the government to tell us to handle our waste. It's our property, and our property rights need to be respected.
Okay, and I was thinking of having about, you know, 25 people say the same thing. This is a very major voice. It's not just like one lone homeowner saying this. It's a strong... Yeah, actually, yeah, this commissioner is troubled by this fact, yes, but there is a strong anti-sewer movement is what they've formed here. Okay, so we got a homeowner number four.
There's many more livestock than people in the county. Even if a sewage treatment plant is built, the problem won't be solved since the livestock will continue to pollute.
Also true. Five, a farmer.
Okay, Canadian geese have been a major problem on the lake and some streams since they need their droppings in the lake directly. Surely they're a bigger source of E. coli than our hogs, which are a half mile from the river. If you're going to pick on the hogs, get rid of the geese as well. I also want to say probably a frog's pooping in the water.
You may as well blame everybody because it's helpful. Okay, and then finally, okay, this is my extension bias, but now we have the county extension educator, which, and this is true also.
That's me. Let's stop pointing fingers and try to get together and solve the problem.
Okay, thank you for that. Now, I just thought I'd open this to everybody. Do you have another one?
Yeah, I'm number six.
Whoops.
What are you?
Six?
Whoa.
I did? Which did I, what are you?
I'm a resident.
Oh, well, let's go with another resident. I must have put the same number or something. Another resident, please.
Now, what about all these pets? People walk their pets around the lake, and they poop all over the place, and people don't clean up their messes, and it washes right into the lake.
Yeah.
Okay, well, now let's open this up to all you other people.
I'm a dog owner.
Okay, and you can choose any role you want. Does anybody else have an opinion? You can be a farmer or a homeowner or the health director or whoever else you might be in a county like this. Do you have some other...
Well, doesn't this show the problem from the, with the non-source? It's just that, it's non-source, so you can't go out and it's your fault, you know. So everybody starts pointing the fingers at everybody else.
Yeah.
Well,
and a woman, you're looking at E. coli, aren't you?
E. coli only comes from one source, right? No, not one source. Fecal matter, yeah, any animal.
In the water, yeah, any animal.
Right.
But it can be, all of these are too, because it can be fecal matter from geese, dogs,
and people.
That's
right.
Elk.
But we're down to,
Well, that would be nice.
Well, then I have a question.
This may be a problem watching. We don't have a lot of elk, but deer. I didn't bring up deer.
Well, the question on that is, if they're blaming the geese. Well, the geese have been around for a long time, longer than Caucasian humans in the North America. Were these streams polluted at that time from those sources?
Not in the quantities that we have now.
Well, you could test that water 2,000 years ago and find E. coli.
Also, you didn't have a lake there. That's
true. You didn't. This is a dammed up reservoir. I mean, this is a...
Well, that's the question. Has there always been E. coli? So has the lake always been unsafe?
It's a natural thing.
Has it always been unsafe?
No, we don't think it's always been unsafe. There have always been E. coli, but as far back as the testing goes, there have been many times when it's not unsafe.
Okay. And then another problem with the E. coli, it's evolving, right? So that it's evolving to the point where it can't be treated by common medicines.
No.
Well, they just had some kids die in Atlanta from a...
Yes, that is a very unusual strain of E. coli, where the E. coli is actually dangerous. It's very unusual. And usually, as I said, we don't have any problems with E. coli. They are not the health risk. It's just that you might find all kinds of viruses and protozoa and other bacteria in water that contain them. But that's right. There was that incident in Georgia in the swimming pool, right, where they came directly into the water. That's sort of a different source of contamination altogether. All right, I don't hear
What's new over the last 5 years? It's changed. Assuming it was okay 10 years ago, what's there now that wasn't there 5 years ago? Nothing to blame that.
I'll be a homeowner and say what's new is the numbers of hogs has gone way up.
The numbers of hogs.
I guess both of these are true. The hog numbers are going up and the number of homes around the lake are going up.
Hogs are a point source. We can identify that one. We can control that one.
Well, so are the septic tanks. But that you can't
you don't have all the septic tanks together. You got all the hogs together. You got to take
the tanks.
Pardon? They're feeding the cattle differently today. They're feeding cattle, Roundup, meat, intestinal parts of other animals.
Yes, but their waste would contain it no matter or what. But that's good to hear what the concerns are. Yes?
Well, the homes used to be not really year-round homes. They used to be just little summer cabins, so the use was much less. And now people have empty bathrooms, and there's so much water that gets flushed every time. They don't let the yellow mellow and so forth and so on. So it's,
Thank you. That's so true. Yes?
Well, can I get my permits next week for the other 10 houses I want to put in?
Absolutely, no. That's a very strong concern. So you're concerned as a developer that this is pretty much going to halt development on the lake. Are people going to want to move in? Second of all, we need realize as the health department, okay, I'll be the health department here, that we really need to crack down, that there's no more building a house on a questionable lot for a septic system, if you do not have the required, well, I won't even say, but there's a required number of acres per number of bedrooms, and boy, you're going to have that amount of lot size that we're not going to let you build. And there are quite a number of existing homes that want to expand or something and can't because of it.
What if the house is there and wants to attempt to fix the septic system? Sort of the problem that Holden has run into here, they try and it's still kind of questionable.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they can be tough in some way. If you don't have the land, there's really nothing that can be done. And that's why there's the move for the sewage treatment plant that people are pushing. Because there are such a number of homes that there's no way they can fix their septic system. So about 40 of them, they have closed down. They're cabins. I mean, they're not huge. But for those people, it's pretty important. They can't improve their septic system, and it has failed. They can't replace it. So there's nothing they can do unless a sewage treatment system is built. Okay, now, so that's a lot of getting at the problem, and thank you. You all provided great suggestions. How about suggestions on what we can do as a community? If we're gathered here together in a community meeting, what might we do about it?
You can force industry out. You can force all the pig farmers to leave and all the cattle people to leave.
Okay, that would not be a popular solution. Recreation is the biggest industry, but agriculture is certainly the second biggest industry.
But it's been done elsewhere.
Well, the question with that is can their effluent be treated so it doesn't pollute the lake?
The hogs.
Right.
Yes, okay, so we can think about that. What can the hog farmers do to decrease the amount of runoff of manure that's running off? Or treat it before it gets to a stream. Now that seems like a very positive step. We don't have to get rid of them. In fact, their practices can be improved.
At a cost.
Composting toilets down at Hill Point Landing. Why don't we all put in some money and build composting toilets and have great gardens?
Well, in the Puget Sound area, that's not a totally allowed process.
Yeah, you can't allow
why
that.
Is
you can't
that
allow that. Park too, they won't let people smoke.
The health department won't allow it.
Because?
I don't know.
I don't know why.
There are some islands, San Juan Islands, where they allow composting toilets, and there are systems from Sweden that have been proven.
Not in King County. It's the largest county.
Why does King County not like them?
I don't know.
Because they're probably no way to control the way
they work. Because
they have to work, first of all. They have to be working.
The legal composting situation is a lot of land I can build on that I can't build on now.
Okay, so we'll look into various kinds of waste treatment. We'll see if we can get permits for some other kinds. Yes.
Well, it seems to me that if you have a stream flowing into a lake and the problem is in the lake, maybe you can go upriver from the lake and see what the E. coli count is there versus the water that's still around the lake. That'll kind of give you an indication of where some of the stuff is coming from.
Right, so you suggest more testing, more detailed testing to try and get at the sources. Okay, and that of course costs money as well. Everything costs money, but do we want to put more money into it to get better testing?
Well, try to figure out where the main source is coming from.
Yes, that seems like
you don't see that. All on everybody's shoulders to say, okay, hog farmers, you do this, or you do this.
And while you're doing that, you could have rules that you can't swim in the water, but you can certainly boat in the water and do things that have recreational activities that don't involve immersing yourself in the wooden area.
Yes, that's true. You can boat. It's the whole body contact recreation,
yeah.
Swimming that
there's
many people
of
like pools that you can't do.
You can then build in the community. To even
not, it's kind of a sad solution. Okay, a couple more, and then we're going to go on. Okay, the second row there.
Okay, what I've seen as a builder in my area in Puget Sound, King County, is the process that they put in place is the health department is the key, and the septic system is if you can't get an approved septic design, you can't build, period. And if you have an existing house and you're going to remodel it, and if you can't get one, you can't build. And if it ever burns down, you can't rebuild. Mm-hmm. And they have tended to shut their stuff. If it's existing, it's grandfathered, legally it's very difficult to touch. But if anything ever happens to it, mm-hmm. they'll touch it and they'll shut it down. Mm-hmm. And
yes,
that's the process that's going on over there.
Yes, and what does that suggest about the sewage treatment system proposal?
It's the only route, but it's money, and you don't have. Usually, it takes a lot of density to cover the cost.
Yeah, but apparently, you know, $35 to $40 a month, is that reasonable to expect everyone to pay, even those who have a functioning septic system?
Not when I have a working septic system.
Yeah, that's the point. That's the problem.
But that's, but what my experience with those processes, everyone votes, and you vote per square foot of what you own, and the majority carries. So if I'm a big developer and I carry enough land, I can punch it in, and you'll get joined in it, and you'll pay your part.
Wait, you have a very organized state. This is way ahead of Indiana. We don't have any system like that. Let's just take two more comments. We have the back row and then the front row, okay?
Well, you might try a set aside, if it's possible, to use a wetlands area. Look at where the flow is coming from, and just try to manage that as an ecological area to take care of some of the affluents and seepage that may be going, use a natural process that they have in some areas.
Okay, so this could be a solution for the hog farmers. Were you thinking agriculture in particular? Because the homeowners don't really have a place for that. But that's an excellent solution, and it's the kind of research that's going on to try and figure out how we can do on-site, you know, ecological, inexpensive treatment. It just takes up some land to reduce some of these levels before they get into the stream. That's an excellent suggestion. And one more here.
And then, assuming that pets and Canada geese are significant, I do the legal and educational laws that you have to pick up the waste from pets, and that you cannot feed Canada geese, and then enforce those, and educate the people. Do not feed the Canada geese.
Education and regulation.
Well, and I have another question. Could the lake be treated, chlorinate the lake?
Oh, well, that's... Let me just finish this up by saying, this is what I'll go back to in a couple weeks. What we're actually going to do, and I'm going to take some of these suggestions, these are fine. What we're actually going to do is have a few public meetings, and the first one that we do have scheduled is for the farmers. And this is where, of course, the Extension Service excels. This is what we're used to doing, and farmers are used to listening to Extension. I think that it's a very tense situation up there because, you know, even as it came out in this discussion, people want to know the cause. They don't know the cause exactly. The most likely is certainly that all of these are true. They're all causes, but people don't usually want to do that. They want to blame somebody other than themselves. So I think there might be a few tense meetings, but hopefully some good strategies can come out of it. You suggested the wetlands, and that I'm not sure if that's far enough along that we'll find any way to actually pay for those. There is, however, good provisions in the current Farm Bill, which is the 1996 Farm Bill, for set aside of land, especially when it's buffer strips along the side of the streams. So I think, I mean, that's something that we're promoting anyway. Farmers can get a payment on the land that they take away from along the side of the stream. And so this should be, you know, a double incentive. First of all, there's the PR problem. They know those high levels, and then they can get payments from the government for environmentally sensitive areas to take them out of production. And out of production in this case, what it's going to mean is not spreading the manure there. If you're not all familiar with how hog waste is currently treated, it goes into some sort of storage, either a pit or a lagoon, controversial in themselves, but those are not, for the most part, the primary cause of the water quality problems. The water quality problems, for the most part, come when the manure is taken out of those temporary storages and spread a couple times a year onto all the land. And if we look back at this particular contamination situation, there were heavy rains, and that's always part of it. And it came quite recently after the wheat harvest. And there's a lot of wheat in our area, not because anybody wants to grow wheat or because you make a lot of money off of wheat, apparently. But it gives you, in mid-July, a place to spread your manure. So all these hog farmers grow a bunch of wheat just so that they can spread it in mid-July, because they can spread it on the corn and the soybean land before it's planted in April or May, but then they don't have any land to spread it at all, so it has to sit in the lagoons till mid-July, and then the wheat gets harvested, so at least on that part of the land they go out, they spread a lot, and then gosh, just then in mid-July, we had these torrential rainfalls, which are always going to happen. I mean, it's not unusual. They weren't 100-year storms, but they were very large storms, 4 or 5 inches in some of the places. And so it's not surprising at all that freshly spread fields, once the rains like that come, that they're going to have extremely high levels. And that's the kind of stuff I'll talk about with the farmers, and they'll say, well, see, it's the fault of the rainfall. Well, it is caused by rainfall, but you have to realize that rainfall is always going to be there, and farmers are going to have to look through the we'll go through the different methods that they can use to try and reduce that.
Has anyone ever looked at a septic system for a farm that would handle animal waste?
The treatment, it's not that different. You see, the theory of applying the manure is similar to the septic system. You're just allowed to apply on top, I guess. Mm-hmm. Also, it is different. It's different. I mean, they would still, when you have to pump a septic system, right? So you've still got that septage to deal with. And
people don't pump them.
Well, yeah, okay, that's another problem.
Are these coming from these factory farms, hog farms, where you have just an incredible amount of sewage created?
In that county, I thought of doing a whole session on hogs and manure, but I wasn't sure if it'd be catchy enough. So we can talk about manure, one of my favorite topics. But these, you might call them factory farms, you might not. They're farmers that have been there for a long time. They're not corporations from the outside. We have very few corporate-owned farms, and that's different than some states. I think even in like Iowa and some of our neighbors, certainly North Carolina, they're large corporations. These are people who have raised small amounts of hogs, as far back as they can remember. But the current economy of hog production makes it very advantageous to go big. So they are big. Some are big, but they're members of the community. They're not people from the outside. The only people who have recently come into the area are the lake homeowners. They're the newcomers. The farmers are the
The hogs are newcomers in the sense that it's like increased by tenfold the number of hogs on it.
Let's say that. So the hog owners, the hog farmers are not new, but some of the hogs are new residents.
And the price of bacon is so cheap and they have to produce so much more.
New technologies have been developed that apparently are not size neutral. And there you can start to look at the land-grant universities and the research. I haven't been involved in the hog production technologies that have been developed at Purdue University and many other universities like ours. But apparently that's what makes the size so much of an advantage because of particular technologies that are now used. So, I mean, there's another ethical question to think about. Do we want to, is there a problem when the new technologies make it inevitable that the big guys go ahead of the little guys? So that's sort of one of the problems. Well, this was much more extensive than I thought. I guess I do want to get to some other non-point source pollutants. We focused on E. coli, and I think it's a good case study because it's typical of a problem. And this sort of a community problem shows how very difficult it is to get at. But let's just look at a few others so that I have a little more meat in this thing here. I hope that you can all see, okay? But I'm just going to run through 5 major categories of non-point source pollution, then a little bit about what we can do about each of them. And you probably face all these to more greater or lesser extent in your community. Some of these overheads are better quality than others. I've used them for various things. Okay, so the first one is sediment. And it's interesting to think about this. There's sediment in these streams in the West. As our Bible study leader brought up this morning, many of the streams, like Railroad Creek even, is braided because it is carrying sediment. So it is natural to carry sediment. In a place like in the Midwest, for example, a lot of the sediment does come from eroded farmland, but it's also coming from stream bank erosion. The reason it's a problem is, first of all, we're losing the soil on the land. I mean, this is your classic soil erosion problem. This is something that's been a concern since the 30s. So that's something we care about because it's very valuable soil. You all know that we only have so much topsoil. Once it's gone, that's all we have until another million years go by and we get some more. I mean, it's replenishing itself, but very slowly. The second one is that it makes the water very turbid, which is bad for aquatic life, harms the fish, and make something like drinking water treatment more difficult. Now, I was talking to somebody beforehand who works for water filtration companies, so I'm sure he's aware of that. Sediment is an expensive pollutant, not because it's particularly harmful, but because you got to get it out of there, and there's so much of it in some places. You've got to filter it out. And then, finally, sediment is a problem because a lot of the pollutants are attached to sediment. Like phosphorus is a good one, and we'll talk about nutrients in a minute. But it only travels with the sediment. It doesn't go with just plain water. Okay, so the sources of sediment, again, are soil erosion, and that one we certainly know about from cropland. There's also soil erosion from construction sites. You developers certainly know about that. But in most of the, well, I should say, there's certainly great efforts being made to reduce soil erosion on cropland. There's also great efforts to being made to reduce soil erosion from construction sites. I think most of the states have laws that have certain practices that you need to follow, right? If you build, you have silt fences and hay bales and baskets in the gutters to keep the sediment out of the storm drains. I mean, if you look at a construction site today, you'll see a lot of soil detaching from where it was, but hopefully it's getting trapped somewhere before it heads for a stream. That's how they're supposed to be. Okay, and then the stream bank itself, of course, can be eroding. All right, so that's pollutant number one, the sediment. Pollutant number two is the pathogen. So I've lumped them all together here because, as I said, with something like E. coli, we lump them together. So E. coli is an indicator that there's untreated waste there. And the problems, of course, we know the swimming advisories. Also, the fish don't like, some fish are affected by pathogens, some aren't. And drinking water treatment is somewhat of a problem. It's not as big a problem for drinking water because we treat it with chlorine, but we don't like to treat whole lakes. That method hasn't, but you know, it's good to be prepared because I bet I'll hear that at those meetings next week. So we'll have to think of a good, reason for that. And we've gone in great detail into the sources. These are the big sources. The septic system, sewage treatment, discharge, our livestock waste. Okay, so that's category number two. Category number three, pesticides. This is real big in Indiana. I don't know if in Seattle, Washington, do you hear much about pesticides in water and drinking water?
Well, they had the ALAR scare right out here in Chelan. From 60 minutes.
Oh, that was on the apples. So.
Apples, but it's
okay, that's on the food, right. But that's the way. Okay, pesticides are becoming more of a concern in food as well as water. I mean, we certainly long tested for them in water, but the new Food Quality Protection Act, which just passed last year, I think, is going to change the way pesticides are regulated because we're required to have a total possible exposure, or total average exposure that we expect to happen. So if you're going to get a little ALAR, let's say, from an apple, you're going to get a little from the groundwater. You now add those together. Plus you add in everything that acts on the body in the same way as ALAR. And all those go together in a risk cup, they call it. And when it's full, then you can't have any more of that. So these things are more combined together than they used to be. With pesticides, what we typically see in the Midwest, and I think it's typical anywhere, is that in surface water supplies, let's say cities are using streams or rivers for their water supply, they'll get really high spikes in the spring. And I didn't bring any graphs, but this is what I often like to show people. But atrazine is the one pesticide that's the most commonly found in water, and its limit, you know, water supply is 3 parts per billion. That's averaged over a whole year. Of course, a part per billion is very small, but that's the health limit. And it regularly shoots up in most Indiana rivers and streams to over 30 for a week or two, and then it'll come back down. So it's after application. If a big rainfall comes, a lot of the pesticide is in the river, but then it comes right back down. Groundwater, we know this has been a long-term concern. If pesticides get into groundwater, that there's a big problem. And the sources of pesticides, of course, crops, lawn and garden, and spills and accidents. But like most non-point source pollution, the spills are not the major problem. The more major problem is just regular old uses, everyday uses of pesticides, you know, like the manure. If you get water and rainfall after it, it's going to cause problems. The fourth category of pollutant, and I said I'm going to have five, is nutrients. So I've lumped nitrogen and phosphorus together here. And probably many of you are familiar with these in different ways. Nitrate is a is a regulated drinking water contaminant. There's a limit there of 10 milligrams per liter, and that's because of this disease with the very long name that I don't usually try and pronounce, but it's often known as blue baby syndrome. Heard of it, where for infants, they can't get enough oxygen to the blood or something like that. And so nitrate is very harmful for infants. It hadn't thought to be harmful for adults, but there was a study recently in Indiana that linked high nitrate levels to miscarriages, so this has sparked a lot of interest in research, and it may be, and certainly we wouldn't want anyone who's possibly expecting or has a baby to drink water high in nitrate. The other reason nitrates have gotten to be a problem is because of this, the reason they're a problem in Indiana is because of the low oxygen zone in the Gulf of Mexico. It's known as hypoxia, or sometimes the dead zone. Sierra Club and others are referring to it as the dead zone. And it's a large area here in the Gulf at the outflow of the Mississippi where fish and shrimp can't live because of low oxygen levels. And they've linked it to the high nitrate levels in the Mississippi. So they've done lawsuits. The Sierra Club and the state of Louisiana, I think, have done lawsuits under the Clean Water Act for our states upstream that use a lot of nitrate to say that they've got to cut down the amount of nitrate that we're sending downstream. That's the issue for us because we're in the Mississippi Basin for the most part. But you've also probably heard recently about that terrible organism called Fusaria in Washington, D.C., to scare Maryland. North Carolina, they've had a lot of problems with the red tide, that algae that causes terrible lesions on fish and also is toxic to humans. I mean, that is one bad algae. And that apparently also is sparked by high nitrate levels. So this has brought sort of renewed concern about nitrogen. And then phosphorus, we've known this for a long time, causes aquatic plant growth in fresh water. See, nitrate is the source in the salt water. And phosphorus is the source in the fresh water.
And nitrogen is coming from the fertilizers, agriculture.
Yeah, that's one of the sources. Fertilizer is certainly a big source. And if you add up the total pounds of nitrogen that it's applied, it's the largest by far. But we don't think that most of the fertilizer that's applied to cropland ends up in the stream. Only part of it does, but it's really, really hard to quantify what part. So let's say maybe 10%, 5%, 10%. Corn, which is the big crop in the Midwest, can only use a part of the fertilizer applied to it, unfortunately. Only part of the nitrogen. So it has to flow on through. It's just the way it is. Livestock waste, wastewater treatment systems, again, septic systems or sewage treatment plant. And then the soil erosion carries some of the nutrients with it. So it's those same sources come back, and then we add fertilizer on as sources of nitrate. So these are real serious issues. Okay, and the last one, I've just sort of done a couple times where I've added this as a fifth pollutant. I'm not sure if that's an accurate thing. Boy, you really, this is out of focus away. Well, anyway, that's a city over there. Okay, the altered flow due to development. Okay, all the stream banks, we see stream bank erosion all the time, and it's always happened. But in many places, it's increasing. The stream banks are really moving out of their banks. The flow is bad for aquatic life, too, because it's becoming more spiky. If you've got an amount of land that's, say, wild land, it's pasture or forest or something like that, and you pave it over for, let's say, a Walmart, the drainage is always going to be put into a storm drain. It's going to be put into a pipe, and as soon as it rains, it's going to flow in, and it's going to flow right to the river. It's probably the same amount of water. I mean, the water, drained through the ground very slowly before, and it just goes really quickly now. So there isn't really a change in the amount of water, but it goes so much faster that becomes sort of a pollutant. So we increase the flooding downstream after a rainfall. Certainly the stream bank erosion leads to higher, those peak flows are what's so harmful. We do reduce the amount of groundwater recharge if we pave over large areas, and certainly reduce the fish habitat. And the key word here is impervious area. How much of a watershed does not allow water to infiltrate is the key for how spiky the flows are going to be, unless we do something about it. Okay, so unchecked, that's the kind of thing that's going to happen. So I'm just going to go real quick here into some of the management practices that farmers are using, farmers and others, you as probably non-farmers, some of these are also relevant. And I won't go in great detail, but I just have one one slide on each of these pollutants, the same ones I went through. Sediment, what we're doing is using conservation tillage. You've probably heard that. The farmers are no longer using moldboard plows to turn over the soil, but they're drilling the seeds right into the soil. And this, of course, means that you have to use herbicides, but in a place like Indiana, everybody's using herbicides anyway, so it actually doesn't result in more herbicide loss, and for the most part, it keeps it down. Vegetated buffer strips, that's what I talked about that the farmers can also use to reduce the manure that runs into the stream. So if the sediment is coming off, it can get deposited in a buffer strip that you put along the stream before it goes in. Construction erosion, we talked about all the things that developers are doing or should be doing, for the most part are. They put, you know, silt fences and runoff basins. You always, and when you construct a site, right, don't you usually have a basin that all the water is going to run into, and so that the sediment is going to be allowed to settle out before it goes out. There's a lot more practices that construction people use than that. There's a lot. And they need to have a plan for the most part. But let's skip that one for now. Okay. And pathogens, you know, we probably talked enough about this in our lengthy discussion before. We can incorporate the manure. We can make sure that the lagoon or storage plant is not leaking. We can keep the livestock out of streams. Okay, nobody mentioned that. Are the cows or the pigs actually walking in the streams? Sometimes they are. Hardly ever hogs. People don't let hogs in the stream for some reason. But cattle are, absolutely. And then maintenance of septic systems and good sewage treatment plants. All these things are being done, but not as much as they probably should. Pesticides, this is probably something I give the most talks on, so you know I've got volumes to say about this. But I'll just say here that there are a lot of practices that farmers can use to reduce the amount of pesticide runoff. So even in using the high volumes that they use in Midwest agriculture, there are many things that they can do to reduce the amount. Oops, I'm just going to go real quick here so we can finish before 11:30. Nitrate is going to move wherever water does. It doesn't need soil erosion or anything like that. It just moves with the drain tiles or whatever. These are things that I mainly talk to with farmers about ways that they can reduce the amount of nutrients that run off. And the final one, as I say, is we want to reduce the impervious area in all new development. And some of you may have been involved in this to different extent. And it's one of the things I'm going to focus on in the talk tomorrow. Today we've talked about the problems that we have, and I'm going to try and focus more on solutions to this non-point source pollution. And the most important thing is the way we use our land, since it's the way we use the land that has the highest effect on water quality. We need to really think carefully about land use practices, whether it's agriculture or development. That's what's going to make an effect on future water quality. So I won't talk about this anymore today. It does seem to be 11:30. But basically, we can reduce the impervious area in new developments and talk about stormwater basins. And we'll go into that, plus some other a watershed management plan that we'll develop together in tomorrow's session. So I've got 11:30. I guess I need to then take any questions that you might have individually. Okay? Mm-hmm. So thanks.
Thank you very much.
And recycle these.
Okay.